It's really great to see such a crowd turned out for tonight, and we're about to consider, most importantly, things that concern life. So we've got a welcome to go out to those who are joining us online and on the internet. So welcome to you and Providence. Brother Stephen, he's asked us to take a reading to introduce his thoughts tonight, and we're reading together Psalm 33. With that in our minds, Brother Stephen, Providence.
Thank you, Ralph. Good evening, everyone. A few things just by introduction before we actually start to get into the subject in any detail. First of all, there are going to be three presentations, God willing. That means you're not going to get the whole story tonight, obviously, and not even the whole story next class. So there may be questions in your mind or thoughts about this subject of providence, but in some cases you're going to have to wait to a later class to satisfy your curiosity and at least hear my opinion on it. So let me just show you what that means. Tonight we're going to work on the subject, God is in control. And we're going to talk about the very big picture here, the whole of creation, prophecy, and a few other things. So we're looking at the macro subject, okay, tonight. Next class, we're going to use the title, You Are of More Value Than Many Sparrows, words of Jesus. And so we'll be looking at providence in the context of the brotherhood generally, not you particularly or me particularly. That comes in the third class, where the title is, It is God Who Works in You. So we'll be talking about walking with God, prayer, God's sovereignty. Do I need two glasses, do I? That's all right. Thank you. So we're gradually getting more focused as we go through these three topics, because it's a very big subject. And obviously if I had one night, I'd be chopping out huge amounts of this and probably trying to get quicker to the part three. But because we have three nights, it's good, I think, because we can start to get our heads around this subject from looking at the big picture first. But as a second thing I want to do as an introduction, and that's how do we read the Bible? Now, it might sound a bit silly because you just read it. What I mean by that is, how do you understand it? How do you interpret it? It's not as straightforward as you might perhaps think, because we're reading an English Bible, aren't we? And it wasn't written in English. So there's always some questions about how clearly the English represents what was the original languages. But I'm not into worrying about the meaning of words. Rather, as you'll see it shortly, it's about our whole approach to the Bible. This may or may not be something you've heard before, but you'll see in a minute that I think it's a pretty important issue, particularly on something like providence. If my talk was on a chapter in the Bible, that's fairly straightforward. We just look at the chapter as a whole, then we look at the sections and verses, occasionally words. That's fine, that's straightforward. But the word providence does not occur in the Bible. So what are we talking about? And it's important, therefore, I suggest, that we get our heads around how God sees the world, how God sees the universe, how God sees the body of Christ, how God sees you. And that's not a matter of my opinion or yours. That's a matter of understanding the way in which God answers those questions. And there'll be a few surprises, I think, along the line, for some of you at least. Okay, how do we read the Bible? The foundation of the Bible is the Old Testament. The first three quarters, in fact, it stands to reason that if we misunderstand this Hebrew foundation, then we construct a system of error. And sadly, that's happened in the world, where the Old Testament's often ignored or seen to be somehow irrelevant, whereas this particular writer, you'll see his name in a moment, thinks it's a very serious omission to forget the Old Testament. It might sound like an oversimplification to say that the Bible is a Hebrew book and must be approached through Hebrew eyes. Now, I think that's the key point, first of all. You might say, yeah, but the New Testament's in Greek. Well, it is. But did the people in the New Testament speak Greek? Well, you might not know. It's not always obvious. But it's clear in the Gospels that Jesus and the disciples would not have been speaking in Greek. And they would not have, when the apostles came to write letters, they were Jews. They were thinking Hebrew language and then converting it into Greek for the worldwide audience. So the writers of the Bible were mostly Jews who thought and spoke in Hebrew. Is anyone here bilingual, like really, really bilingual? Yeah. Now, what language do you think in when you're speaking English? Yeah. When you speak German, what language are you thinking? Yeah, and you would have years ago, yeah. You switch to the other language in your head, even though you then might speak in another language. Their New Testament Greek, that is the New Testament writers, was based on the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So when they refer to the Bible, they're meaning the Old Testament. And whilst they might be talking to people who speak Greek, and they might be using the Septuagint Bible, that's simply a Greek translation of the Hebrew original. And so their minds are still in the Hebrew language, albeit then speaking in Greek. And of course, we know that it's the same God in the Old and the New Testament. So kids, stay with me here. I know this is a little bit, where's this going? Well, you'll see shortly. There's you'll see the reference in a moment to this book. It's called The Distinctive Ideas of the Old Testament. And so there's a sentence which ends with that phrase, the distinctive ideas of the Old Testament religion. These are different from the ideas of any other religion whatsoever. In particular, they are quite distinct from the ideas of the Greek thinkers. The aim of the Hebrew religion was Da'at Elohim, meaning the knowledge of God. Okay, so the Old Testament, which flows into the New, is all about knowing God. We wouldn't have a problem with that. But the Greek thought was gnosis, know yourself. Now, it's a fact, which I won't go into explain now, that our Australian, British, European, North American, whatever, Western culture is Greek. Our language is Greek derived. Our thinking process is Greek derived. Our politics is Greek derived. So we've been born into a system where the way we normally think is Greek. When we come to the Bible, it's Hebrew, and it's very different, as you see with that point. Between these two, there is a great gulf fixed. We do not see that either admits of any compromise. They are fundamentally different in a priori assumption, in method of approach, and in final conclusion. Now, that's an important principle we're getting here. Our normal way of thinking is governed in our whole society and the whole Western world from originally a Greek way of thinking and a Greek way of explaining things and of presenting ideas. The Bible's utterly different. Okay, so that's important when we talk about providence. We're not getting into some sort of philosophical, theoretical idea. We're going back to God's Hebrew Bible, Old and New Testament. One more. This is by Brother Harry Whitaker in talking about Jesus and the little child. You know, he tells the disciples to allow the children come him to him because they are an example of the sort of people who will be in the kingdom. So he, Jesus, enunciated one of the most important principles to be found in all his teaching. If any man desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. This does not mean that the man full of ambition will be punished for his self-seeking by being brought down to the lowest place. Rather, the disciple who would have the highest honour from his master can achieve it by readily accepting the role to which no kind of honour attaches, being everybody's slave. Here, as so often happened in the teaching of Jesus, there is a complete inversion of human standards and judgments. The world's sense of values is always wrong. Now, I've chosen these three slides to make you stop and think. You may think it's a bit overstated. I don't, but that's okay. What we're trying to get across here is that the way we think about providence must not be based on human thinking, what we think is fair, what we think is reasonable. They have no value unless we listen to what God's saying and believe what he's saying. Okay, here we go. What is providence? Well, there's any number of definitions. The first one I don't think is helpful. Guardianship and care provided by God. That sort of sounds like God's nice. He will always be nice. And if something is not nice, well, that wasn't God. Well, that's not going to stand up to scrutiny. Because we know from the scriptures that God does good and evil. Good things and bad things happen to his people. So we can't talk about providence as just a nice warm fuzzy thing. Providence is therefore about all of God's work. Everything God does, everything, is what we're talking about in this subject. It is seen and felt in everything, not just unusual things. Here's what I think a better definition. Providence is the means by which God directs all things, both animate and inanimate, seen and unseen, good and evil, toward a worthy purpose, which means his will must finally prevail. So we're talking about how God does everything. And we know that includes a lot of things in the world that are terrible and occasionally things in our life which are terrible too. If we only look at the unusual and the beneficial events, then we may think God is uninterested in us most of the time. Because most of the time we don't have anything spectacularly wonderful happening. And then most of the time we don't have anything particularly beneficial, it's just normal everyday life. And if therefore we only think God's involved in the really good and the really spectacular things, what about the rest of the time? The Bible's very clear that God's involved with us 24/7. So we need to think a little differently perhaps than that first definition. So this idea that it's only the beneficial things is clearly untrue. So how does providence work? Well, you're not going to get the answer tonight because, as I said earlier, we need more than one session to do it justice, and we've got three. So let's start opening up the subject. I'd like to do that by saying there's a danger in making God too small. Now you might think, oh, I don't make God too small. Well, perhaps you might sometimes. The Bible's our only source of knowledge about God and his ways, so that's what we're going to do. And there's a hymn 357, that says of God, there is nothing too big and there's nothing too small. I reckon that's brilliant because that's exactly the point I've been leading to. Think of just two examples. A big example, the angel of the Lord smote 185,000 Assyrians in one night. That's a big thing. That's an example of what God can do. And then there's the small things. God knows when a sparrow dies and the hairs of her head are numbered. Well, for some here, that is an easy task. But for most of us, that's quite a hard job, isn't it? So if we think about the whole of God's family for a start, there are 60, 70,000 of us, something like that. And each of us have got thousands of hairs on our head, and God's numbered every single one. Well, you're starting to see what we mean by providence now. God's involved in everything. Now, this word, magnify the Lord. There's hymns and songs that use this expression, and we might think of it as just meaning, oh, it's just to praise God. But it's not that. That's not what it means. What is, in normal language, if I say I'm going to magnify something, what am I doing? Make it big. And I might have a magnifying glass to do it, mightn't I? That's what it means. It means to make God big. He's not just a very clever human-like thing that's struggling to cope with everything that's happening on this planet. He's big. And we need to think of him as big. Make him bigger than you normally do. That's going to help. And just a few examples there of how this word is used. Mary magnified the Lord and so on. The last two, God's greatness is unsearchable. So we'll never, ever comprehend how big God is. God is everywhere and at the same time cares for each one of us. That's not an easy concept to really grasp, is it? We don't question the language. That's fine. We agree with that. But what does it actually mean in practice? What does it mean to you in your daily life today? How have you seen God's care for you today? Or is it just another day? Well, we've got a very interesting expression in the Old Testament about God's hand. And the idea here is, I'll grab any one of you, stand up. Yeah. This is what we're talking about with God's hand. Can you feel it? Yeah. Can you feel it? No, thanks. When it talks about God's hand, it means you feel it. You know that God's doing something to you. Now, I'm not talking about a physical feeling, because obviously God's not got a physical hand to touch us like that we would notice. But it's an idea, so let's look at it. It's all the way through Ezra and Nehemiah. They both were absolutely sure, they saw it, they felt it, that God was working in their lives to bring them back from Babylon, to rebuild Jerusalem. They felt the presence of God. But there's some challenges in the Bible. Just to quickly look at the example of Job, we read that he was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. We're told that three times. Three times. So there's no argument about whether he was maybe not such a good fellow and that's why God did all those things to him. No, can't say that. He was perfect. And he said when he lost his children, his property, his servants, everything, the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. So he knew he'd got them originally from God, and he knew that God had chosen to take them away. Now that sounds a bit like a bit blasé. Well, I don't think he was saying it in that tone. But then in chapter 2, Satan, whatever, whoever that is, you incited me against him, says God, to destroy him without cause. He had done nothing wrong. So all those catastrophes that came upon him were not because he was a naughty boy. He wasn't being punished. And if something really bad happens to you, you can't necessarily, or I can't necessarily say, aha, you've obviously been a bad person. That's why this has happened to you. You cannot say that. It's possible that it's true, but the only one who can say that is you, by looking inside you and examining yourself. But no one else can make that judgment because no one else has a clue what's going on inside your brain, but God does. Jesus twice talks about this dilemma of bad things happening to good people because he was confronted with this on more than one occasion. There was in Luke 13 the example of many Galileans slain by the Romans. Other people had been quite casually just standing around having a chat, and this huge stone-built tower fell down and killed them. And Jesus says, well, they weren't better or worse than anybody else, so don't judge those people. And then in John 9, we have the extraordinary example of the man born blind. Now, you remember what the disciples asked Jesus? Yeah, now, does that make sense? Who sinned? Why have they said it's a sin? He was born blind. They've assumed that that bad thing was because somebody had sinned. Wrong. So then it was, who sinned? This man, but he was born a day-old baby. Do they sin? No. So that was a pretty silly question. Or his parents. Now, does God give you a deformed child because you've been bad? What an incredibly silly question they asked. Why did they ask such a question? Because they had this concept that every sin is punished now in this life. And every good deed is rewarded now in this life. And they were wrong, wrong, wrong. This is part of the distorted thinking that they had picked up, which is not what the Bible teaches. People use the term these days of karma, don't they? Oh, you know, that happened to them. Ah, that's karma. They got what they deserved. That isn't the way it works. Okay. But we also know from well-known chapter 1 Corinthians 11 where the Lord Jesus does chasten us. So there are times when we are being chastened to stop us going in the wrong direction, to correct us. Because they care about us, the Father and the Son care. They're not going to just let us run riot, as a poor parent might, but they're going to say, no, you need discipline. And so sometimes we need to look inside ourselves and say, well, this bad thing that's happened, maybe I am being disciplined, but only you, as I said, can judge that. So not all bad things that happen to us are because we did something really bad. And as I said also, it's important to examine ourselves. No one else can do that. It is better, and this is a point I really want to get across tonight, it is better to see God's hand, but perhaps we're wrong, than to not see it when it was there. I'll say that again. It's better to see God's hand and be wrong, it wasn't, than not to see it and just, no, God doesn't do things in my life when he does. I'd rather be wrong in the first case of thinking that all kinds of things in my daily life are God working in my life. And perhaps they weren't. But isn't it better to think that way? To actually feel the hand of God and to live that every day of your life with that kind of feeling? And it doesn't matter whether you were mistaken. It's a good way to think. It's a good way to live. On the other hand, if you just say, well, you know, I've lived whatever number of years you've lived and I can think of a couple of times where I think God intervened in my life, and that's all. The rest of the time, he's not even interested in me, doesn't even know I exist kind of attitude. That's terrible. So let's see some of the big picture stuff fairly quickly, I hope. God the Creator. Well, we all know that from Genesis. It's repeated in Exodus that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days. And you may have seen this cartoon, two kids talking about this subject. And the boy says, 6 days? And the girl says, yep. True, six, truly, really days? Yep. You're sure it says 6 days? Yeah. I wonder why it took so long. And that's a good question. We're not going down to talk about that. But when we think about God could have done all of that in 6 days, in 6 seconds, or even 1 second. Right? So let's keep God as big. That's the message here. Now let's think of some examples. And here we'll just turn up that psalm reading we had, Psalm 33, which you now may recognise as being one that talks about God's creation and his power to do that. We'll just pick up from verse 6 of Psalm 33. And note the point here that it says at the beginning of verse 6, by the word of the Lord. And that's what we read in Genesis, isn't it? God said, let there be light, and there was light. God said. All he had to do was say something, and it happened. He didn't have to physically somehow or another get involved in manufacturing anything. He just said it, and it was there. And that's what we read in verse 6. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deep in storehouses. Verse 8. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. So it's exactly what Genesis told us. And it's being repeated here by the psalmist. And we won't turn these other ones up, but in Psalm 148, it talks about God making the, or in other words, creating the angels. I don't think there's any mystery about where the angels came from. God made them. Isaiah 40 talks about the heavens being stretched out, and certainly they are, aren't they? Okay, some numbers here. Who knows roughly how many stars you can see in the night sky in the middle of the outback? Sorry? Lots. 6,000-ish. You're right. Maybe it's 7, perhaps even 8, but it's around that number. So we'll pick the 7,000 as my figure for halfway. That's how many you can see. Imagine Abraham being told he would have as many children as he can see the stars in the sky. He'd go, well, eventually, after a few generations, yeah, 7,000, That's nice. But God also said, you can have as many as the sand on the seashore. Now, he would have, I'm sure he had plenty of intelligence, he would have gone, hang on, there's a lot more than 7,000 grains of sand on the beach. Just one beach would have many more than that, let alone all the beaches of the world. And somebody has gone to the trouble of estimating how many that is. Sand, apparently it's 7 to the power of 20. That's a mind-bogglingly huge number. But it's estimated that there are even more stars than that, 10 to the 24. So Abraham would have then concluded, oh, well, I can only see 7,000, but obviously there's a lot more. But it took until the 20th century for anybody to figure that out. But he knew that 2000 BC. We're dealing with this big God. I guess that's the point I'm trying to stress here too. Now think about our solar system. Sun and moon, we know from Genesis and the sun. Actually, we'll look at that one, Psalm 104. Psalm 104 is a really interesting psalm on this topic of God's power and his creation. So 104 verse 19, he appointed the moon for seasons, the sun knows it's going down. So, and we know that from Genesis as well. So the seasons are part of God's creation. And then from that came all the festivals, you know, the Feast of the Ingathering, the Feast of Pentecost and all those. They're all seasonal festivals when the harvest was coming in, for example. Okay, so that's all part of the natural order. We understand that. But now I want you to think about, why do we have something called a year? Well, I'm sure everyone here knows that's how long it takes for the earth to go around the sun. Fine, it's a natural thing. The month, oh, well, that's how long it takes for the moon to go around the earth, roughly. And we know that varies a little bit because they don't quite line up after 12 months with the solar year. But the idea of a month is based on that. A day, well, we know that one too. The earth rotates on its axis. But where did the concept of a week come from? Creation. There's nothing in nature that takes a week. Nothing. So we have a week because God created everything in a week. Okay? That's really profound, I think, because we just take it for granted. We have weeks. But the only reason we have weeks is because God created everything in one week. What about the weather? Well, we all joke about the weather and the forecasters, but just look at this list again pretty quickly. In Job, it talks about a great wind across the wilderness that came from God. And that in Job 36, God sends the rain and clouds to judge and give food. Lightning and thunder, snow, whirlwind are for correction, for his land or for mercy. And while you've got perhaps still Psalm 104 there, let's have a look at verse 13 and 14. He waters the hills from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, and vegetation for the service of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth. And you might say, well, no, that's actually not correct. The water cycle is just a natural cycle. There's sun shines on the ocean, evaporates the water, it goes up into the sky, cools down, forms a cloud, drifts across to the land, hits a mountain and falls down as rain, or something like that. Well, that's true. But the Bible's telling us God does that. And the question really is, do we believe Psalm 104 or do we believe the weather forecaster? or people like that. And so that's rain for the service of man. Now, I'm not going to start telling you whether the fact that we've had a drought is because Australians are bad people, or that it has nothing to do with God, or it does have something to do with God. We can't tell. We just don't have the power in our brains to work out whether everything that happens with the weather is God pressing this button or pulling this lever and making this happen everywhere around the planet. Because our brains are going haywire at this point. Because as a human being, we can't imagine how God could be doing that, because you've made God too small. You don't think he's got that power. Well, of course he does. If he could create the universe in 6 days, but, well, and maybe a lot of that in one day or two perhaps, we just cannot begin to question what God can and can't do, or what he does do and doesn't do. These verses, and many others, as you see on this slide, are saying, well, all these is God working. And we won't read up any more, but there's just quite a list of examples of where God's saying, that weather event was me doing that. And the same thing applies to earthquakes, Korah, Dathan and Abiram, Elijah in the cave, at Christ's crucifixion, at Christ's resurrection, Paul and Silas in prison, which set them free. So you might just say, but that's just 5 examples and all the other earthquakes are just random events and God has nothing to do with them. That's not the message we get from the Bible. He just happens to tell us that these 5 were important and had a particular purpose. The rest he doesn't say anything about. Plants, well, you might think, God's not involved with the plants. Oh, isn't he? Well, he created self-generating plants with seeds in them, right? And we all know the plant cycle. But that's how God created it to do that. And then when sin came in, he brought thorns and thistles. And in Leviticus, it talks about there'd be no fruit for the disobedient. Psalm 104 again, verses 16 to 18. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, the cedars of Lebanon which he planted, where the birds make their nests, the stork has her home in the fir trees. The high hills are for the wild goats. The cliffs are a refuge for the rock badgers. Now, that's of interest to me because I've actually seen a rock badger, but you'll have to wait to the next slide. The lilies and grasses of the field, it talks about being placed there effectively by God himself, and one day the Edenic curse will be removed. So I guess I'm trying to just keep building up this picture that things that we just think are normal, everyday, not important, the Bible's telling us God's involved in all of this. So animals, in Genesis, all the different animals created. In Job, it talks about God provides for them, a bit like we just read in Psalm 104. Job talks about giant animals, huge animals, behemoth and leviathan. Whatever they are doesn't matter tonight, but we know from, you know, caves down the southeast, there's bones of animals that are bigger than animals we have today. And that's not a particularly shattering piece of information. We know that in the past there were much bigger animals, and those words convey that. We won't look at these, but you see the reference there to birds, goats, rock badgers and lions. Well, on the right, that's a rock badger. And they live in the valley in En Gedi, just from near the Dead Sea. And they're pretty cute. That's an ibex over there. I took both of those pictures. They're just examples with birds as well, and although I didn't take those 2 pictures of the birds, I've seen both of those birds. This is called a griffin vulture. And that's a hoopoe. You see them all over the place. I'm just not as good a photographer to get a picture like that. So we've been told again and again and again in the Bible that things that we think are just ordinary are very much part of God's way of working. And so we're just going to look now, just not at any great length, at God's work in prophecy. Now, prophecy is not simply foretelling the future. You know, there are people who claim to be able to tell the future, either looking at the palm of your hand or in a crystal ball or your cards or whatever. It's not just that. What is important in the verses we'll just look at in a minute, it's telling us what God will do. He's not just saying, I can see into the future and I can see, oh, that's going to happen. Oh, that's interesting. I'll tell you about it. He's saying, no, I'm doing that. It's not just going to happen. I'm doing it. Amos 3 verse 7, surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. He's doing it. Isaiah 46, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. Okay, you get the picture, hopefully. There's another one. So shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please. It shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. So it's not just God foreseeing the future or foretelling it. He's telling us, this is what I'm going to do one day. And 2 Peter 3 verse 8 has a rather interesting statement that with the Lord one day is 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day. Well, okay, but what on earth is that saying? What's the point? If we say, well, you know, God's not interested in how long something takes and we go, oh, well, I am. I wish it happened quicker or something. Is that all Peter's saying here? Or is he saying this? I think he is saying this. God is outside of our physical time-constrained existence. He is in the future. Now, I know from physics and whatever else, that's impossible. But we're dealing with God, not with what humans think is possible. What God is telling us, that he's in the past, the present, and the future, and those time differences for us mean nothing to him. He's equally able to talk about himself in the future and telling you what's happening as he is in telling you what happened in the past or the present. And that takes a little bit of brain's power for us, doesn't it, to get our head around the idea that time is irrelevant to God. He talks about time for our benefit, but he's not worried about time in the way we are. And when you get old like me, time becomes rather more important because you're running out of it. Now, just a quick example of a very obvious case or an example of God's prophecy is the Jewish people and Israel. We won't turn much of this up. It'll just, if you want to start turning to Romans 11, we'll look at these as we go through. So the first one is in Romans 11, where the Apostle Paul says, Israel has not been cast away. Verse 2, God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. There's a word, foreknew. He knew before. Well, we don't know anything before it happens, but that's just God does. And he goes on to quote from an example of Elijah. So the Jewish people have not been cast away, contrary to the views of many Christians. Their scattering in all the nations has been foretold several times. their fall away from God's way opened the way for us to become God's people too. So verse 12, same chapter. Now, if their fall is the riches for the world and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? Paul's saying this. Well, because they didn't accept Jesus as their Messiah, the gospel then came to the Gentiles. That's us. And we are incredibly grateful for that, because it's the riches of the world, the riches for the Gentiles. We're rich, spiritually incredibly rich, because the Jews rejected Jesus as their Messiah. But at the end of the verse he says, but when their fullness comes back, which means they are going to be restored, they will be in the kingdom as God's people, then we better be careful, because if they can be cast out, so could we, as he goes on to talk about. Their preservation is foretold, example of Jeremiah 33. Their return to the land is foretold. The sign of the fig tree is mentioned a couple of times in the New Testament. The fact that they would find resistance from their neighbours, and isn't that the case right now, and has been for years, that the neighbouring people around Israel are not happy that they're there, and they occasionally burst out and have a war or throw rockets over the border, and so it goes on. And Zechariah tells us that, well, we can't resolve this problem. Nobody in this world can solve that problem. There's no solution until Christ comes. Their restoration is a sign of our immortality. Look at verse 15. For if their being cast away is the reconciling of the world, that's us, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? So when they are accepted, when Christ comes and they go, oh, we made a big mistake here, now we accept you as Messiah, it happens at the same time as the resurrection from the dead. That's for all of God's people who have died. We read in verse 25 that at the moment they're blind. Verse 25, for I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So in other words, when God's time in spreading the gospel to the Gentiles has come to a point where that's enough, then that's when the blindness of Israel will be removed. And that's also in that verse 25. Now, finally, just a personal view about God's providence on the big picture here. In the first century, let's just pose this question. I know we use the term first century measured from the birth of Christ, but forget the birth of Christ bit for a minute. Whatever label you want to put on that century, why was it that century that the gospel was revealed to the world? Why not 2 centuries earlier or 2 centuries later? Why that century? Well, it's very providential. The Greek language was the common language throughout the Roman Empire and even beyond. So you could present the gospel in one place in Greek and another place in Greek, and people would understand you. The Roman army built roads all over the world so they could run thousands of troops from here to there to stop some uprising. That meant, of course, if you wanted to spread the gospel, you had a nice highway to walk along or ride a donkey or whatever mode of transport. Thank you, Roman army. Made my job easy. And the same with going by ship. There's always been a problem of pirates, of people who would want to take all the wealth that you're carting around the world on a ship. And the Roman Navy pretty much put an end to it. Again, so Paul could travel by ship from what we call Israel today across to Rome or wherever and not have any problem. So that's the whole world was ready for the gospel to be spread by language, by road, or by ship. What about our times? 19th century providential communications. Somebody invented a steam engine, and suddenly you could have trains and ships powered by steam, and you could get from one place to another many, many times faster than you could ever do with a horse and a coach or whatever. So speed of travel became really significant in the 19th century. And the other thing they clever people did with these steam engines is hook them up to a printing press. Instead of printing one page at a time, they could print thousands. And they could put them into books, and they could put them on a ship and go woof, around the world. And that did happen. But it never happened before. Now, yeah, we've advanced a bit beyond that. But the point I'm making is, these changes in the world, to me, are very providential. Anyway, that's it for tonight. Next class, as I mentioned earlier, we want to talk about the fact that you're of more value than many sparrows. Thank you.